The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Fury in Ferguson, killing of an unarmed black teen after a petty crime leads to protests, provocative peacekeeping, and new questions about police force.
Progress in Iraq. Thousands are saved from that embattled mountaintop, we're told, and the divisive prime minister resigns under pressure, but ISIS terror is spreading.
Comedy and tragedy. The suicide of madcap performer Robin Williams after a long battle with depression and addiction shocks and saddens fans worldwide.
The language of houses. Pulitzer Prize winner Alison Lurie has a new book about how buildings old and new speak to us and about us.
Daring, My Passages. After years profiling VIPs and key social trends, Gail Sheehy has a new book about herself and challenges other women to dare as well.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of August 17th, and another birthday for me, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. You're welcome. I'm awesome. That was Texas Governor Rick Perry pumped after being thanked for a speech at the candidate-friendly Iowa State Fair. He also shook the hand of a 10-year-old girl there so hard she couldn't feel her fingers. Later last week, Perry was indicted by a grand jury for abuse of power by cutting funds to state prosecutors probing public corruption. Now this.
You may no longer be in the area. It is no longer a peaceful protest.
Today, I'm announcing that the Missouri Highway Patrol, under the supervision of Captain Ron Johnson, who grew up in this area, will be directing the team that provides security in Ferguson.
A white patrolman's fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, in largely black Ferguson, Missouri, led to days of outrage, violent protest, and military-style police counterforce last week until Governor Jay Nixon turned command over to state troopers under the leadership of a sympathetic, charismatic black captain. That night was peaceful, but violence erupted again after local police finally identified the cop who killed Brown, but also released photos, video, and police reports indicating the 18-year-old, just about to enter college, had just been involved in the strong-arm theft of small cigars, though exactly how that related to his death remained to be fully explained.
The fury in Ferguson and police killings from New York to New Mexico, Miami to Beaver Creek, Ohio, raised nationwide concerns over excessive force in law enforcement and over continuing racial tensions between police and communities they are meant to protect. To consider these issues for Your Ears Only, we're joined by Eugene O'Donnell, a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, after service as an NYPD police officer, police academy instructor, and district attorney's office prosecutor. Welcome to the program. With no pictures or video of Brown's killing, we have competing accounts that he was shot after trying to grab patrolman Darren Wilson's gun or while raising his hands and pleading, "Don't shoot me." If the first situation is proved, would that give the officer reason to shoot even if he saw the boy was unarmed?
Yeah, if it's clear that the individual is unarmed and he is surrendering, obviously a shooting would be violative of the law. The difficulty you have with police officer situations is they have broad authority to use force. And when a police officer says, you know, I was fearful, and articulate some reason to have that fear, that's always a difficulty. The officer does not know the ending. We know the ending. The officer doesn't know the ending. So that's always a complicating factor, complicated even still further by this appearance of this video.
Does it matter that Wilson did not know Brown was a robbery suspect when first confronting him over blocking traffic, but later saw cigars in his hand and made the connection?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the sequencing. I listened to the press conference, but I think the police would say why that matters is that while the officer may not have known about Brown's involvement, Brown knew about his involvement if he was indeed involved, and he would have acted in accordance with that involvement, being erratic, being suspicious, not being cooperative, or being assaultive. That's what the police would say, assuming that you credit any part of that account.
While investigation of the killing proceeds, let's turn to police procedures that followed. First, leaving the body in the street for hours, then mobilizing military-style crowd control. Many across the country and in Congress say too much military gear has gone to too many police departments without the training to really know when and how to use it. What's your view?
Well, it's unequivocally true. We have to reckon with that. 18,000 police departments, some great departments, some departments that are scary, and to be handing out weapons, we have to have serious strings attached. We have to have oversight. And local authorities can't really do it generally. So you can't just say, well, let the local town council do it. There has to be better oversight. But having said that, we have to also recognize that post 9/11, post the Boston, you know, marathon bombing, that it is a different environment. And while this week's story is about police not overly reacting, it's possible that next week's story will be about the police not reacting. So we can't lose our equilibrium. But yes, there are serious concerns about militarizing the police. It changes the ethos, which really should be service and de-escalation. So the serious consideration has to be given to reforming that whole DOD process.
What about the disparity between a majority black town and an almost solely white police force? How common is that these days? Does it inevitably shape police-community relations?
It does. I do think that police-community relations are shaped mostly by the fact that we've disinvested in many American towns and cities, and there's not a whole lot on offer. And I think minority America is well aware we're sort of building a country where they're not included. And, you know, the policing is sort of secondary to that reality. But obviously, the other thing that is quite obvious, the American police footprint's too big. They're overcharged with too many responsibilities. I think the chief said these guys were walking in the street the other day. You know, I understand strategic decision-making about going after minor offenses, but we have to really reckon with if the police are going to constantly be having these conflicts with people, there is a likelihood of force being used in all of these situations. And we just keep passing laws and ordinances that put the police directly in conflict with people.
How common and effective are racial sensitivity programs for police departments, whatever their racial composition?
You know, they're helpful, but I think the transformation we hope to have in American policing, we all have to keep our hearts and minds and fingers crossed, is that the younger generation of people, and certainly in my experience, this is, I think it's true, they're too sensible and wise to buy into the bigotry and racism of yesterday. Because I do believe in policing, the transformation has to come at the bottom, not at the top, not preaching. People have to really believe it and see it and replicate it. And we have to drive out bigotry and racism. There has to be, you can have any politics you want, you can have any disagreement you want, but when people are using racial epithets or stereotypes, it's got to be cops who say that's not tolerable in our workplace. You can't be talking like that.
There's a growing call for more police officers to wear the tiny digital cameras now so readily available, so all their actions are on record, not subject to self-serving or hostile witness accounts. Some 1,200 officers around the country now reportedly are so equipped. Many departments already have cameras on their patrol cars. What's your view?
The cops tend to like them once they get them. They resist them initially. They tend to like them. I'm not sure citizens are going to like the fact that every interaction they have is on camera. There's a real Big Brother aspect to that. And I'm not sure it's the best interest of having a trusting relationship between the police and the community. And also, I have serious concerns that police departments may, and this is pretty common in the country, trouble on 12th Street will drive on 11th Street. So I'll have fewer adversarial encounters with people. And who's going to suffer? Public may suffer in that scenario.
How do you see high-profile incidents like Ferguson and the fatal chokehold on a large black man in New York suspected just of selling loose cigarettes? How does that fit into the overall image of police training, procedures, community relations in the years ahead?
None of it's helpful, but the only sure answer, again, which seems to be a non-starter, is to have a look in the mirror and recognize this is what the police do. They can talk to people. They can try to get people to cooperate and acquiesce. But the police are a force-oriented organization, and you simply can't be adding laws every year and increasing their mandate and pushing them forward and then being surprised, shocked, to find out some of these encounters end badly.
Eugene O'Donnell is a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. After service as an NYPD police officer, police academy instructor, and district attorney's office prosecutor.
Next, shifting sands in Iraq, military and political, for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Exelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It was a gut check to see if Ukraine will defend itself. That was Vladimir Fresenko, head of the Penta Political Research Institute in Kiev, after the central government reported destroying a column of military vehicles crossing the border from Russia. Moscow denied such a mission, while a larger Russian convoy waited near its side of the border for Red Cross inspection to confirm it carried only humanitarian aid to embattled separatists around Donetsk and Luhansk. Now this.
We helped vulnerable people reach safety, and we helped save many innocent lives.
وأعلن أمامكم اليوم ولتسهيل سير العملية السياسية وتشكيل الحكومة الجديدة سحب ترشيحي لصالح الأخ الدكتور حيدر العبادي.
America's military return to Iraq escalated last week as humanitarian aid and protection for Yazidi minority refugees on a mountaintop near Erbil morphed into attacks on a key dam held by Islamic State extremists near Mosul. And Iraq's paralyzing political logjam finally broke as Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki accepted growing pressure to resign so new leaders can try to end the isolation of Sunnis that has helped fuel the spread of those Islamic State forces from across the border with Syria.
The situation continued to raise fears of U.S. mission creep on one hand and of a new home base for terrorism on the other, threatening those considered unbelievers in Iraq, across the region, and perhaps as far as America itself. To consider those and related issues for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and director of the Stanford University Center for Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. A former coalition advisor in Baghdad after President Bush's shock and awe assault, he's also the author of Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq, and later The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, David.
Were you surprised that U.S. Special Operations personnel so quickly declared the refugee crisis on that mountaintop ended? Maybe a little convenient. Some international observers say thousands of Yazidi are still threatened there and elsewhere.
Well, everything is relative. The initial reports that it was 20,000 or more, now it seems to be in the low thousands. I don't think we can declare the crisis over, and we've got to find a way to get them off that mountain.
Do you see U.S. military efforts to recapture the Mosul Dam as mistaken mission creep or a more limited effort to protect the Kurdish area that seems the most stable in all Iraq?
Well, Melissa, I don't mind mission creep because I think that we need it. I think we should have done more sooner. I think there's an existential crisis facing Iraq now. Terrorist army, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, is running amok over Iraq and Syria, and it's got the potential to destroy Iraq. And with it, the most successful achievement that the U.S. has had in Iraq, which is the support for really fairly democratic and pluralistic regional government in Kurdistan. So I think we absolutely need to do more to help this country defend itself.
On the political front, what chances do you give Iraq's new prime minister from al-Maliki's own Shiite party to develop Sunni support? What concrete steps would you suggest?
Well, I think the concrete steps are obvious, and they are the ones that we took after the last military surge in 2007-2008, which would not have succeeded without a political surge, which involved outreach to the Sunni tribes in the region. And he needs to do that again, and he needs to bring in Sunni Arab politicians into his government and make clear that he's going to seek a very pluralistic approach and not victimize his opponents in a vengeful fashion, which is the way Nouri al-Maliki increasingly governed over his turbulent time in office. Iraq is actually one of the largest oil producers in the world. They don't seem to be short of money. And the Iraqi government could redirect some resources to these Sunni tribal councils and to people who are willing to come on board if they have the political will to do so.
Could they take control back from forces of the Islamic State now?
Well, I think eventually they could. It's going to be a very long struggle because this is a formidably determined and surprisingly capable enemy. I think that the United States needs to be prepared to use air power to restrain the movement of ISIS and aid Iraqi military campaigns to roll it back, probably for some time to come. It seems to have had some impact. It really might have saved Kurdistan.
After seeing video of those Islamic State forces using U.S. equipment abandoned by Iraqi government units, do you think it's wise to provide more such equipment there and to the moderate rebels in Syria who seem frequently overwhelmed both by the Islamic State extremists and Assad regime loyalists?
It's a tough affair and I would even say agonizing question, but each instance has to be weighed on its own merits and prospects. In Syria, we weren't talking, about the provision of heavy weaponry or highly sophisticated weaponry, but, you know, the basic ability of moderate elements to fight against the state. And in Syria, it's possible it may be too late. I think the president has waited far too long and has been far too cautious and, frankly, was disingenuous in his interview with Tom Friedman when he said, you know, they're just a bunch of professors and doctors. How could they be a fighting force? A lot of resistance forces, you know, started that way and developed capability over time. In the case of Kurdistan, I think we should give them everything that they want and might possibly need. They're a capable, disciplined state. They have a capable, disciplined army. I think they can make effective and secure use of these weapons.
How large a threat to America is establishment of the Islamic State in Iraq or major areas of it, as opposed to the spread of its ideology elsewhere in the region, to Europe and beyond? Is in the age of internet and global air travel, is geography really important?
I think your question just answered itself. It's less important than it used to be. And I think if you're going to rate threats to the national security of the United States, you would probably have to count ISIS now as a more serious and existential threat to our own territorial security than al-Qaeda, because al-Qaeda is not in control of any significant piece of territory. And ISIS is, and they have the momentum. They're so ruthless and violent that even al-Qaeda found them too extreme. And there's absolutely no doubt that if they're able to establish a secure foothold in this territory spanning Syria and Iraq, that eventually they will try and use that as a base to strike not only Europe but the United States.
Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and director of the Stanford University Center for Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. A former coalition advisor in Baghdad after President Bush's shock and awe, he's also the author of Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq. And more recently, The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World.
Next, Robin Williams and the Tragedy of Comedy, for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. I leave my own personal views at the door as a judge does. That was Professor William Shabas, a Canadian expert on international law and critic of Israel's Palestinian policy, after Jerusalem criticized his being named chairman of a UN commission to investigate possible war crimes in the current conflict over Gaza, where a 72-hour truce was to expand to 5 days. Now this.
I'll go incognito.
Why are you taking my dress?
Well, better way to hide than one of your dresses, men. You know hiding is a drag.
San Francisco, where God save the Queen, has a different meaning. Yes.
You don't know about real loss, because that only occurs when you love something more than you love yourself. I doubt you've ever dared to love anybody that much.
Mr. Latin, sir, what will your pleasure be?
Let me take your order, jot it down.
You ain't never had a friend like me.
And there ain't never been a performer quite like Robin Williams, from comedy club stand-up to a TV debut as the alien in Mork and Mindy to winning an Oscar for Good Will Hunting and voicing the genie in Aladdin. Not to mention Good Morning Vietnam, Dead Poets Society, Mrs. Doubtfire, The Birdcage, Creepy Insomnia, and One Hour Photo. But the joy he brought others was overmatched by his personal demons, and at least briefly last week by the shocking news of his suicide at age 63. Tributes came from David Letterman, Jimmy Kimmel, Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Minnie Driver, and millions of fans across the country and around the world.
Details of his death came slowly, first that he was battling chronic depression, then a recent return to rehab, finally word from his wife of early Parkinson's disease. While it seemed absurd that a man who could make the world laugh should be so pained himself, it's not uncommon, psychologists say, indicating a clear connection between comics, depression, and bipolar disorder. Indeed, the Laugh Factory in Hollywood, owned by a friend of Williams, even retains a psychologist to work with its comics. She's Ildiko Tabori, Ph.D., and for your ears only, she's on the line now to talk about it all. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Is depression and suicide really more common among comics than other aging white males, or are we just more likely to hear about it and be struck by the contrast of their comedy and personal tragedy?
The research does show that there is a link between comedians, stand-up comedians, and depression, and to a lesser extent, bipolar disorder. But I do think that there is depression in the general population. I mean, it's pretty significant, and we all experience it at some point in our life.
Are comic sensibilities and manic depression two sides of the same coin with common roots in brain chemistry and function?
I don't necessarily think that there's a relationship between bipolar disorder and comedians, but there is a honing of comedic skills in younger years, especially when it's surrounding depression. Depression, I believe, predates the entrance into this field. Humor is a defense mechanism, and the defense mechanisms are what we think about when we are dealing with the sadness and depression and the pain of our childhoods and things like that. So those skills get honed at a very early age, and that might be the precursor that leads them into this field.
Williams once said, stand-up is the place where you can do things that you could never do in public. Once you step on stage, you're licensed to do that. Do the comedy clubs provide comics a place for sort of self-medication beyond booze and drugs, a kind of talk therapy for those who feel they don't fit in most other places?
I frequently say that being on that stage is therapeutic, but it's definitely not therapy. I think that the comedians do work out their personal pain up on that stage, and they put a comedic bent to it, a funny bent to the pain that they already are feeling, but it's not completely allowing them to work through the pain. And that's why I'm there, and that's why we're there as a team in terms of providing the treatment over at the Laugh Factory.
You've noted that many comics are afraid to have their depression treated because they feel the pain is important to their comedy. Talk a bit about that.
They're not going to stop being funny when they feel better. The depression is going to come back. It's just to what extent, and knowing how to recognize the symptoms and dealing with the symptoms, that is what's important.
Well, you've said that the comics especially and actors like Philip Seymour Hoffman are quite talented at disguising symptoms of depression. For those of us outside show business, what are the most common warning signs of depression or bipolar disorder to look for in ourselves or others?
Well, those are two separate things, depression and bipolar disorder. But one of the things that we do need to recognize in depression are, you know, changes in sleep patterns or changes in appetite. Somebody's gaining or losing weight rapidly in a very short period of time, there might be something going on. If somebody's sleeping a lot or they're not sleeping enough and they are constantly fatigued, that is another indicator. Things like isolative behavior is a big one. Lack of motivation, something we call anhedonia, which is an inability to experience pleasure in everyday life. And another big one is anger and irritability. Those are symptoms of depression.
And if we see those symptoms, what's the best way to get someone the evaluation and care they need?
when you're in the middle of, especially a manic phase, there's not a whole lot anybody can do. There's not a whole lot that I can do as a professional other than, you know, provide the support and get them the needed treatment and medication that they absolutely 100% need. When people are in a manic phase, unfortunately, there are two things that happen. They either end up in jail or they end up in the hospital, and that's when those things start to get treated. But I think the best thing that we can do when we are noticing that somebody is going through these experiences, especially with depression, is to talk to them about it. I think we are afraid to ask questions that are kind of scary, like, how are you doing? What can I do to help you? You seem like you've been spending a lot of time alone, or you've lost a lot of weight. What's going on? We're afraid of those answers.
How does news of a suicide like Williams, and especially details of how he did it, affect others who suffer? Afterwards, do more people seek help or follow his footsteps?
I expect that there will be some acting out on some level, meaning that the depression may increase, the anger may increase, and that's why we're there. When I read the news on Monday afternoon, my immediate reaction was to contact the Laugh Factory and say, make sure we remind the comedians that we're here for them.
Dr. Ildiko Tabori is a Los Angeles clinical psychologist, available to comics at The Laugh Factory in Hollywood, as arranged by owner Jamie Masada, friend of the late Robin Williams.
Quote from the news, I'm thankful my 14-year-old son did not bring in the mail. That was a message on the Land's End Facebook page after the retailer sent loyal customers a gift copy of GQ magazine with a nearly topless model on the cover. Absolutely obscene, said another Facebook posting.
Next, the language of houses beyond all the bills. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Hard to save lives if we and other health workers cannot get in. That was a Twitter message from the World Health Organization after Korean Airlines suspended flights to Kenya, a major gateway to Ebola-plagued Liberia, Nigeria, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. The Ebola death toll there passed 1,100 as the small supply of one untested treatment for the disease was demanded and finally delivered. Now this.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard. Life used to be so hard. Now everything is easy 'cause of you.
Malvina Reynolds' classic critique of suburbia and the great group Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young with a different view of home. The houses we live in say different things about us to different people. So do the buildings we work in, play in, pray in, and archive the best of our literature and art. Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and social critic Alison Lurie considers the many aspects of architecture in her book, The Language of Houses, How Buildings Speak to Us, new this week from Delphinium Publishers. And to speak about it for your ears only, Alison Lurie is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Before this book, you wrote The Language of Clothes, about how what we wear has changed through the ages and what our choice of apparel says about us at any particular moment in history. Are the buildings we design and construct as revealing of who we are or want to be?
Well, not always. Most buildings are collaborations or compromises, developers versus zoning boards. At home, if you live alone, yes, it's just as revealing. But if you live with somebody else, you've got to compromise there, too. It's a compromise between, say, your husband's love of sports trophies and memorabilia and your love of paintings of flowers and landscapes. So it's not as single-minded as what somebody's wearing.
Talk about some of the things a house can say about us. Do big windows say we love what we see out of them or long to be seen through them?
Well, I think it can be both. In an apartment high-rise, everything is all view, and people aren't thinking of showing themselves but of looking at what's around them. although I've learned through my research that sometimes they're wrong because a lot of apartment dwellers keep a pair of binoculars on the shelf under the window, and one of the things they do when they're bored is look at the other high-rise buildings.
What about houses that are symmetrical, door in the middle, same number of windows on each side, versus those that are not? My wife and I had a one-story ranch house to which we added a two-story addition on one side. Will people passing by suspect we're unbalanced?
Absolutely not. We only really expect that kind of symmetry from public buildings. And we only expect it even with public buildings in the front. Sometimes if you go around the back of a big town hall, you'll find it's just as uneven as your or my backyard. A few buildings are symmetrical both front and back, like the United States Capitol, but it's rare.
I've seen pillows that say, my other house is neater. Do people with two homes, a weekend or a vacation place, generally keep them up differently?
I think they do. After all, in a vacation house, nobody's going to see it except your children and their friends and your own best friends. So you can be more relaxed. You don't have to worry about whether everything is absolutely clean, absolutely tidy, absolutely new.
Let's talk about public buildings, starting with museums and libraries, temples of learning and culture, but not always built like temples anymore. The newly relocated Parish Museum in Southampton looks like one of the local horse barns pumped up on steroids. Do you think we lose something by forsaking old-fashioned grandeur, or at least some indication of the treasures we value inside a museum?
I think it depends a lot on what sort of art is inside the building. The elaborate 19th century buildings that we're used to go to see famous artists of the past, like the Metropolitan Museum, they're right for these paintings. The Southampton Museum probably has mostly modern art in it, and if they do have, let us say by accident, the Rembrandt or Turner of a very rich local resident, it's going to look small and sad in an airplane hangar-type building.
What can you say about actual temples, churches, synagogues, mosques, how their designs vary from religion to religion and over the ages?
Well, I think you can tell very much about a religion from the way its meeting place looks. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been into a Quaker meeting house, but there's nothing in it except rows of benches arranged around a central space. For them, God is a spiritual presence, but not so much a physical presence. Whereas if you go into the European Baroque Catholic Church, it's all plaster angels and images of saints and a huge gold organ. So it's a different idea of what heaven is like, what God is like, and it's very visible at extremes like this.
And what about commercial establishments, shopping environments that scream save when they mean spend?
Oh, they all do that. Even the most polite local craft shop in Southampton is telling us that there are bargains here. You'll feel better when you buy these things. They don't. No one's going to put up a sign say "spend money" because it'll make us react against it.
Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and social critic Alison Lurie considers the many aspects of architecture in her book *The Language of Houses: How Buildings Speak to Us*. New this week from Delphinium.
I'll light the fire while you place the flowers in the vase that you bought today.
quote from the news, "Don't do stupid stuff is not an organizing principle." That was Hillary Clinton on President Obama's foreign policy in an Atlantic magazine interview. She later called the White House to patch up relations, and she said she looked forward to hugging it out when they met at a party on Martha's Vineyard. No photos of hugging emerged, but a good time seemed to be had by all.
Next, to encourage daring women, author Gail Sheehy for Your Ears Only. A little more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. You know what you learn if you're a New Yorker? The world doesn't owe you a damn thing. That was Brooklyn-born Jewish Betty Joan Persky, who got quite a lot as the pouty-lipped, husky-voiced model-turned-actress-turned-icon Lauren Bacall, including husbands Humphrey Bogart and Jason Robards, and a fling with Sinatra. She died last week at 89. Now this.
Have you got any castles that you want me to build, baby? Have you got any dragons that you want to have killed, baby? I'll get into my seven-league boots. I'll get into my bulletproof suits. I'll get out my revolver that shoots. And rat-a-tat-a-tat, down they go.
Nancy Lamott gives a contemporary feminist feel to that 1937 song written by Johnny Mercer and Richard Whiting for Dick Powell as male lead in the movie Varsity Show. Now veteran journalist and author Gail Sheehy, famed for her Passages books on key phases of men's and women's lives, is doing her part to encourage distaff daring with a new memoir titled Daring, My Passages, from HarperCollins. She's also launched an interactive internet campaign for young women called The Daring Project at SheeheDaringProject.com. And to talk about both for Your Ears Only, my friend Gail Sheehy is on the line again now. Welcome back to the program.
I love being with you.
Let's start with the memoir. What's the first episode of personal daring you detail?
Well, I talk about taking the longest walk of my career, which was from the estrogen zone of the women's department at the New York Herald Tribune, where you had to write about, you know, cooking and fashion, down the back stairs, sneaking down the back stairs and across into the testosterone zone, the men's, where all the men worked, in the sitting room, and all the way to the door of Clay Felker, who was starting the precursor to New York Magazine. Scared to death, but I had a story to pitch, and I figured this was my big chance.
Let's talk about the Daring Project. Who is it aimed at?
It's aimed at young women because, you know, my book is all about being in the 60s and the 70s and then all the way to the present day. But young women really don't know that history, and I want them to be excited about daring. We had a lot higher mountains to scale in the 60s and 70s, and today they have social media and computers and wonderful Wi-Fi cell phones, and they can work from home. But it's still tough. You still have to be daring to, you know, get ahead of the crowd and make an impact. So this She Daring Project, I'm inviting young women to send in the daring moments in their early lives, and then writing stories about them on the website, and then asking accomplished women, what was the daring moment in your early career that helped you catapult your career forward?
Well, I'm interested in the young women. Talk about the blind editor you feature on the Daring Project, the website.
Well, Michelle Hackman, I thought was amazing. This was the day of the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. Michelle Hackman woke up with her own terror. She couldn't see anything. Her retina had detached, and surgery wasn't going to be able to bring back her sight. She was only 8 years old, and her parents told her she'd have to give up gymnastics. Well, she said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to let blindness stop me from doing what I love to do. So she did it. She continued doing it badly. She taught herself how to read the New York Times in Braille in middle school, and she became a very early adopter of social media. So she could really report and write and communicate with people. And she's now at Yale, the city editor of the Yale Daily News, even though she's blind. So she dares to dream dangerously. She wants to be a White House correspondent.
Another case of daring involves not so much making waves as taking them on, surfing. Tell us about that young woman.
Well, she was going to Wesleyan University. She'd always been able to get A's, very conventional life. And her best friend was killed in an auto accident with her whole family. And the best friend had been planning to go to Cape Town, South Africa to expand her consciousness. So Rachel could not go back to college. She just felt she had to go and have that experience for her friend. And her parents said, well, you better have a plan. So she said, I'm going to come out in an hour with a plan. And she came out of her room an hour later with a one-way ticket to Cape Town, South Africa, which she paid for by herself, and she decided that she would learn how to surf. So she spent 6 months trying to learn how to stand up on the darn surfboard, and she was never very good at it. But she had a fabulous experience living on her own with six other girls in a beach house and learning a new language and realizing that you can try something and not master it, but you wouldn't die from it. And that allowed her to change her life again when she finished college. Instead of going to work as an art historian, which she'd been trained for, she found she liked writing. So she took a writing MFA, and she's now writing her first novel.
Will you keep Project Daring in the digital realm, or will there be some real-world gatherings, a national convention perhaps, or maybe local workshops and affinity groups?
Well, I'll certainly try to spread that idea as I do the book tour, and I'm making speeches around the country all through the fall up to Thanksgiving. So I'll have a chance to excite young women to start those kinds of affinity groups and share their daring stories and buck each other up about taking chances.
Gail Sheehy is famed for her Passages series on key phases of men's and women's lives, now including a new memoir titled Daring, My Passages from HarperCollins. Her interactive campaign for young women is The Daring Project at SheeheyDaringProject.com.
Well, have you got any mortgages you want to have paid, baby? Have you got any villains that you want to have laid to rest? After all my adventures are through, and I bring home a dragon or two, you can tell all the papers that I did it because I love you.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on air is also online at iTunes, feedburner.com, stitcher.com, and going back years now at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago.
This week last year was marked by the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March on Washington and of Dr. Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech there. From our August 18th, 2013 broadcast, hosted by Melissa and me.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
50 years since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. stirred a historic crowd of 300,000 on Washington's National Mall, largely but not solely African-American, his optimistic vision has come closer than even he might have anticipated, from the subsequent Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts to the nation's first black president. But as a new cadre of civil rights leaders this week prepares to mark the anniversary and the progress, it focuses as well on problems that remain, from economic inequality to police profiling to the Supreme Court's recent reining in of voting rights protection.
Just last week, for example, a federal judge in New York City declared the police department's controversial stop-and-frisk policy racially discriminatory and unconstitutional and named a special monitor for the NYPD. And the Justice Department said it would no longer invoke mandatory minimum sentences for minor drug crimes that have affected mostly minority males. At the same time, North Carolina's Republican Governor Pat McCrory signed a sweeping restriction of voting practices, including the requirement for government-issued photo ID, more limited early voting days, and the end of same-day registration, all of which followed the cutoff of state unemployment benefits for an estimated 70,000 residents, which also cut North Carolina off from further federal jobless aid.
To consider the progress, the problems, and the 50th anniversary program for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Marc Morial, president and CEO of the National Urban League, a mainstay of the 1963 March and this week's as well. Thanks for speaking with us again.
I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you for having me.
What's your most vivid memory of the 1963 March?
I was 5 years old. My father and mother were frontline participants in civil rights. What I remember was not so much the March on Washington, but I remember the local march, which took place in New Orleans about a month later. And one part of the history of the March on Washington is that there were 40 local marches that took place in conjunction with the march. The one in New Orleans, 10,000 people marched on City Hall. My father was a leader of that effort at that time, and my mother did not allow us as children to attend because there were great fears of violence, that the Ku Klux Klan and other supremacist groups would attack the marchers, and it would be an unsafe event. As history goes, it was a safe event. Now, I remember, as I've studied and looked back on the March on Washington, the importance of the unity. And while it was a predominantly African-American crowd, organized labor played a huge role, and there were religious leaders from the Greek, the Jewish, the Catholic, the Presbyterian, and mainline Protestant denominations who participated and actually spoke at that march at the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963. And it's important to remember that while Dr. King's speech was, I think, the highlight and the most memorable component of the march was much, much larger than that single speech, much, much sort of a compilation and a coalition that worked very hard in the year of 64 and 65 and 66 and 67 and 68 on things like the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the War on Poverty programs. It was a heady time in American history and a time of great change.
A main feature of this week's proceedings in Washington is a panel discussion on the next 50 years, Freedom Forward. What's the issue or challenge you're most interested in seeing considered there?
I think we're talking mainly, number one, about jobs and economic inequality, which persist and which has worsened, particularly in the aftermath of the recession, and a challenge to the nation at large with the changing demographics. I think, secondly, the assault on voting rights. You mentioned North Carolina. There are some 25 to 30 states that have reintroduced North Carolina-like legislation. This reminds us less of the 1960s and more of the early 1900s when literacy tests and the grandfather clause and all sorts of efforts were undertaken to try to restrict and prevent African Americans from voting. These new restrictions are a threat to American democracy, and they are an issue of these times. Thirdly, I think very importantly, is the growing coalition that you see in the nation, African Americans, Latinos, people from the Asian community, the Native American community, the LGBT community, women's rights advocates, and other people who classify or may consider themselves progressives, working together on a broader coalition, which is really about fulfilling the true meaning of Dr. King's dream, but also the meaning of the words of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. That's a struggle and a fight. And I think what we see today is a new assault coming from, I would call, a very extreme interest on the right side of the political spectrum, who are cutting off unemployment benefits, who are assaulting voting rights, and who are basically pursuing an agenda which I think would reverse progress in this nation. And that's really why the march that will take place next Saturday in Washington, D.C., is not only a commemorative march, but it's a continuation march. So we'll be heavily focused on not just remembering the past, but on reaffirming a commitment to the future.
What was your reaction to the ruling against stop and frisk in New York City, where the National Urban League has its headquarters? Some supporters of the practice claim it saved thousands of lives in minority communities where fatal shootings are most common.
You know, I was mayor of New Orleans, and we, one of my signature achievements was the reform of the New Orleans Police Department and the reduction of violence by some 60-70% in a 7-8 year period. And I believe that widespread use of stop and frisk is not only unconstitutional, but it's ill-advised as a law enforcement tactic. Stop and frisk also undermines confidence in the police. And when you undermine confidence in the police, it's not helpful to the overall goal of a safer community.
Mark Morial is president and CEO of the National Urban League, a mainstay of the 1963 march and this week's as well.
We will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
The Dream at 50, from our August 18, 2013 broadcast. To mark 50 years since President Lyndon Johnson signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Mark Morial last month again noted progress, but also lingering gaps in economic income and opportunity for African Americans, even in the forward-thinking high-tech sector. He also continued coalition-building efforts, inviting Libertarian Republican Rand Paul and GOP National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus to the Urban League's National Convention and joining the fight for more humane solutions to the crisis of child refugees at the nation's southern border.
Morial's concern about police-minority relations remains relevant in light of this month's killing of an unarmed teen in Missouri and the fatal chokehold on a suspect in New York. The battle over voting rights and practices also continues, with the Justice Department winning a federal case against Wisconsin's new voter ID law, but losing its effort to block new voting restrictions in North Carolina. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now all of Nancy Lamott's celebration of female daring.
I have dreamed about romance a lot. Men like Galahad and Sir Lancelot always did the things I'd like to do. Physically, I'm not as durable, but romantically, I'm incurable, and I'd like to do the same for you. Have you got any castles that you want me to build, baby? Have you got any dragons that you want to have killed, baby? I'll get into my seven-league boots. I'll get into my bulletproof suits. I'll get out my revolver that shoots. And rat-a-tat-a-tat, down they go. Have you got any mortgages you want to have paid, baby? Have you got any villains that you want to have laid to rest? After all my adventures are through, and I bring home a dragon or two, you can tell all the papers that I did it because I love you. Men are really men no longer now, for the weaker sex is the stronger now. We compete in every single thing. Gents belong in the Smithsonian, since we gals are all Amazonian. And the queen has now become the king. Have you got any mountains that you want to have clomb, baby? Have you got any oceans that you want to have swum, baby? I'll get out of my bonnet and shawl. I'll get into my nothing at all. I'll let out with a Weissmuller crawl. And over the waves I'll go splash, splash. Have you got any continents you want me to fly, baby? Well, there just isn't anything Amelia and I won't do. After all my adventures are through, hang up a record or two, you can tell all the papers that I did it because I